Okay, let's get started. First question I have for the class is, who might want a recommendation, co-term recommendation, or other kind of recommendation from me ever? Okay, all right. No, not you guys. Okay, so it's important for you guys. I'm very happy to do co-term recommendations, but as far as other recommendations, I'm not sure I'm the right person because I'm not even a professor. But co-terms I feel comfortable doing. So I really like to write nice things about students. But I like to write nice things about students when they are doing good things. So it'd be good if you let me know how smart you are by participating in class and making me aware of how smart you are. So, you know, keep that in mind. Next question I have is, how many people here already have a PRL shop pass that are doing projects? How many people have enrolled for 3 units and do not have a PRL pass? Four. Okay. So what I think I'm going to do for you guys, and you should thank me for this, is I'm going to fund your PRL Room 36 pass for this quarter. Okay, so on Thursday there'll be a sign up for people who need a PRL pass. So that's good. So if you found that you don't have time to work on a project this year, a team project, you know, you can work on a project as independent study later, or next quarter you can take this class as independent study and work on a team project, or you can work on an assistive technology project, perhaps in ME113. We've done that before. Professor Waldron is teaching ME113 this year, so you may want to ask him about that. You can also work on assistive technology projects over the summer if you're going to be a junior or a senior, and I've coached students who are working with this Surrey program. You ought to check it out. It's really interesting. You get a stipend for working on a research project over the summer. It's a good deal. For the RAFT projects that Greg Brown talked about on Thursday, there's lots of different projects there, so it's okay if there's a couple student teams working on separate projects. It was very, very popular choice last year, so it's okay to have several teams work on RAFT projects. So I asked the question, in your quest to save the world, how many people do you actually have to save? Has anybody thought about that? Give me a number. A number between 0 and 7 billion. What do you think?
I think 100.
100 people? Okay. How many people have another response?
So if you save one person in such a way that they can save other people, then...
Okay. Anybody else?
I'm not sure if the number is
really... Okay. Okay. This is a trick question, by the way. Kevin? Okay. Wow, that's very poetic. Almost...
What do you mean by safe?
I don't know. It's not a religious thing.
It's
not meant to be religious. Anybody else has anybody else reflected on this question? No? Who wants to know? What, 0? Why 0? No one goes. Okay, so you mean saving a person is making them immortal? Is that your definition of saving the world? Okay, I don't know. Okay. The answer is, if you save one person, you save the world. Because for that one person, you're saving them, you're saving their family, their community, their country. You don't know what good that one person can do. There's a lot of people around that have been saved and have really gone on to do good things. So what does that mean as far as this class? Is that I want you to be comfortable in seeking out people with disabilities to work with, because you might save that person, and in doing so, you'll save the world. And also, you get an enormous feeling of satisfaction and achievement. And for that person, they're going to be forever grateful to you. So, you know, you shouldn't think about, you know, this amorphous thing about, you know, building a device that will, you know, provide cheap power for everybody. It's just as good to save, you know, one person. Okay? So, that's what I wanted to say. Team project selection. So I hope by now you've looked at over the team projects and gotten more information from the person who suggested it. And you want to email me your top choices. And a number of people have already done that, and there are several people who haven't done that yet. So please get that to me as soon as you can, because once all those are up on this website, then people can start forming teams. There's already... So go to this website and figure out who wants to do what and maybe start forming teams. I would like to have, you know, people have their teams formed by the end of Friday. So you have a little time, but get me those preferences now so I can post them. There's no guarantee that other people are going to have their same interests, so be prepared to convince others, maybe even strong-arm them to work on one of your projects. Consider working on somebody else's project, or you can work on a project as a team of one. That was done last year with some success, so you're welcome to do that. For those working on team projects, once you have your team formed, let me know the team members, no more than three. I'd like for you to come up with a name for your team, a name for your project, and a name for your device maybe later on. And you can also come up with a logo if you're so desired, because that would be a good thing to put on your device. So think about all that stuff. A little bit about the engineering design process. It's a little bit different maybe than you've heard from the D school, but a lot of it is sort of the same. Understanding the problem, that's the empathy part of design thinking. Figuring out from the problem what is needed by that individual. You want to look and see what has already been done on the internet. You want to know what products are out there that address this problem, why they haven't been successful. So that's, you need to do that. That's the required part. And the fun part is brainstorming, and we'll be doing a little bit of that today. You select one of your ideas and fabricate, test, evaluate, and repeat, you know, just like shampooing. And ultimately, you want to report your results in class in the presentation, and also write a report. And then you also want to reflect on that experience. So that's what we're going to be doing. But engineering design process does not include building to somebody else's specifications. If they have a drawing for you and they say, "Build this for me," that's not designing. That's fabricating. And making incremental improvements on things that are already out there is not designing either. So there's a lot of people that are on your team. If you don't realize it, there are the resources of PRL in room 36, the people who have suggested the project, and the course resource people who I mentioned on Thursday. And I'm a resource too, so be sure to get in touch with me. It's important that you make and justify your own decisions. If I ask you, why did you do that, you should say, because I thought that was the best thing, rather than saying, well, somebody else said that I should do that. That's not valid. People who are working on individual projects for one credit, you want to consider these options that I mentioned. You want to talk to a person with a disability, and including the folks in class, community members in class. You want to work on one of these projects, figure out which one you want to do, and meet with me and have some ideas about projects, and meet with me and we'll, you know, discuss all of them and decide on one for you to do. It's perfectly okay to just write a paper. You can do a paper design of something. You can, if you happen to be an art major or music major, you can do a work of art. You know, anything that's within your skill set. You want to use those skills. And I mentioned about aftermarket aesthetics, functionality, and usability. And I can give you examples of those. Let's go. Project documentation. Now, I don't require you to have a lab notebook, but I know that ME113 does. So if you want to get practice on doing things in a notebook, that's fine with me. I'm not going to ask for it, but if it helps you get through your project, that's fine. As you're working on your project, I strongly suggest that you document what you're doing. Take pictures of things. I especially want pictures of you working with users. I want to have pictures of you using the design process, you know, at a board brainstorming. You know, that would be a great picture. I want pictures of all your prototypes, even the ones that don't work. I want you to document your failures because, as you see, you'll see those are important. Your most limited resource is time. And to tell you the truth, even though we just started, there's only 7 weeks left in the class. So you want to budget your time. I encourage you very strongly, and the last class encourages you to start early and start fast so you can get ahead of the game, because you don't want to be waiting until the last minute because everything else is due at the last minute. So this is really good advice, so I hope you take it. For students working on team projects, the midterm presentation is 4 weeks away, so that doesn't give you much time. Now, there are a lot of these student design competitions. The one I've seen posted around is this one by an organization called Metropolis. Their entries are due next month, so maybe you can give them a, you can send your entry, would be a prototype of what you're doing in this class. The Resna Student Design Competition, that's an easier deadline in April. If you're one of the 10 finalists, you get a free trip to Seattle, the whole team. I've compiled a bunch of other design competitions on the course website. Check those out. That's a good thing for you to do to gain some recognition outside of Stanford. So on Thursday, Debbie Kenny's going to be here. She's a occupational therapist. She'll bring some of her students who are people who have had a stroke, and she'll be talking about her perspective as an occupational therapist and interviewing these people who have had a stroke. So that'll be very enlightening on Thursday. But today, we have a duel of guest presenters. I worked with both of these individuals at the VA, a good source of guest lectures, I found out. Gail is a design consultant in the Bay Area. He specializes in user interface architecture and design strategy for online ventures and interactive products. And John Tang is a senior researcher at Microsoft Research, and he has a Surface there, so you may want to, you know, talk to him afterwards. He designs and studies new tools to support distributed collaboration, which he uses to connect with his research team up in Redmond from here in Silicon Valley. So while we're moving slides, it's maybe a good time for you to take a stretch, and we'll get the guest lecturers up here. Thank you.
Actually, while Nate is queuing those things up, I will say a little bit more about my background, which is... Dave at the Rehab R&D Center over at the VA as a biomedical engineer, and was a lot involved with kind of documenting other people's projects and figuring out how to explain, you know, what other people were doing when they were doing that finite element analysis and like that. So it was a useful period, but my most recent experience is doing user experience design at Yahoo and several other, you know, other startups locally here in the Bay Area. And in addition to that, actually, I've taught a couple of classes here. One in computer science for about 10 years. I taught this class. It was called, we called it HDI Design Studio, which was mostly about helping computer science students kind of understand how to design things that people were actually going to use. And it was sort of interesting, on the very last day of class, we had the project, one of the students came up and says, you know, I never thought about the user before. You know, she had done the databases and the algorithms, you know, she was straight CS, and I guess this is kind of like part of her major to figure this, and it was an eye-opening experience to come from that point of view. So I'm fascinated with kind of the whole process of, like, how do you design for people, how do you design with people, you know, how do you kind of put people first in the picture? And today, we want to talk about this, the idea of need finding. How do you kind of understand what people want, what they need, what they're looking for? And then we're going to actually, you know, the important part, we'll kind of set that up with some high-level things and some specific techniques. John's going to talk about some specific techniques. Then we're going to have an exercise. We'll kind of break up into little groups to sort of practice thinking about, okay, if we were going to work on this particular project, how would we go about learning about that? And so one thing about doing this exercise is that it'll be kind of a little dry run for trying out how you like one of the projects that are kind of in the offing. And there's no commitment involved. You can try it out, see what it's like, see what's like, how other people are thinking about it. And then at the end, we're going to kind of like hear from people what, kind of, so that you can hear what other people thought about the same kinds of things. Okay? So, the heart of the whole idea of need finding is this pyramid. Abraham Maslow kind of formulated this idea in the 40s. And how many people have seen this before? Okay, great. And so I have come to kind of a slightly different point of view about talking about this. Often people are talking about, well, the basic principle is that we need to satisfy these low-level needs in order to enable us to work up toward the high-level needs of self-actualization. And what is he has, and this particular slide has, you know, morality, creativity, spontaneity. See, these are high-level needs that we need to work toward. But we can only do it if we satisfy, you know, if we can breathe, if we got food, if we're safe. These things build up to that. I wanted to suggest another point of view, which is that, you know, as individuals, you know, we're driven by a high-level need to kind of be what we are, be what we can be. And, you know, we're sort of here on Earth, and we have, you know, we kind of need all these other things to deal with in order to satisfy those high-level needs. And kind of, it's a point of view of thinking about, yeah, we're not just looking at the little thing, we're really enabling a person. If we're coming, like, from an engineering-solving, problem-solving point of view, if we want to build something that actually solves a problem for somebody. You know, let's think about what's the highest kind of impulse or motivation for this person. How can we really help them do things up here by meeting the needs that are down there? So that's just the high level concept. So this is a model that I got from one of the old hands here at what used to be called the design division, Bob McKim. Sort of formulated need finding for the product design program here. The notion that need and capability are kind of like complementary forces that are acting upon us. In fact, he used to say, you know, if need is the mother of invention, capability is the father of invention. So we need something, whatever, you know, we're trying to satisfy physiological need. Well, we have these capabilities. We all have some capability for mobility, for manipulation. Like, these are the tools we have as humans to meet these needs that we have here. And so, somehow, if something goes short or missing, you know, we lose some capability on one of these dimensions, you know, the needs are still there, then we kind of look, well, is there a way we can kind of amplify the power or the value of one of the other capabilities to help to satisfy the needs? One thing that that I think a lot of people learn here in the Valley is that, you know, there's kind of like two sources, two main driving factors for invention or innovation. One is, you know, often it's a better, you know, we come up with a better solution to the problem. Say there's a problem of, you know, driving far or reducing global warming or something like that. But then if you look at, if you think of it as a kind of a double-sided problem, there's another way that a lot of problems are solved is understanding the need. You know, you realize that if somebody is trying to do something, you know, sending a lot of email, it's not about sending messages. It's really about connecting with somebody else, and maybe there are other ways to enable people to feel connected and be connected. So this is another concept too, which is like, you know, somebody says, I need, you know, a faster chair, a faster car. Well, then when you start probing into it, you realize, well, really, do they want to feel like they really want to feel like they can fly. And these levels of needs are, like even a car. You know, I need a new car. Well, here's an old Chevy. No, I want a Tesla. Oh, Tesla's, all right, okay, that's fast. And so this is like, you know, I may think I need to get around, right? I need to just move from point A to point B, but why do you want Tesla? Well, I want to show that I'm like, you know, I'm part of the Silicon Valley elite. I can get around. I can afford things. I'm success. So these, you know, having the Tesla versus the old Chevy, you know, means you're kind of, these are things that are kind of driving you here. And the second principle is that to distinguish between needs and wants, you can do that, but save that for your dissertation. Because as far as what we're doing here, developing a need and a want is kind of like the same thing. It's driving us. And often things that we call, oh, you just want that, it's really kind of like one of these higher level things that a person is going for when we think that all it counts is moving from point A to point B. So that's kind of a framework for thinking about need. And we need to kind of talk to people, watch people. We need to kind of do things with our users here. And the big thing that's interesting, if we're designing for assistive device or for disability, is that it's usually obvious that, you know, we can't just design for ourselves. We can't assume that, well, we know what that's like, what's that about. So we don't need to actually talk to anybody. You know, it's really dramatic that you need to actually try to understand what's going on with the person. And so what we're going to talk about today are some techniques for, first of all, trying to understand in a particular situation, what is the person trying to do. And I don't know, did you have Fernando here last week and they had the, I'm thinking of an example, just use the example of the sailing the sailboat chair, right? So somebody could do that, right? So if you think about, well, what do they want? Well, they want to sit in a chair, but there's kind of more going on than sitting in the chair. It's so that they can go fast, so that they can kind of be part of other sailing events. They can be on the water. They can feel like they're flying, being safe. So trying to understand not just a chair is a chair is a chair, but there's more kind of around having that chair. So this is, so I've kind of broken this out, like you talk about the goal is, well, there's, you know, I need a chair, I need to be able to be secure on this boat. But then you kind of understand more around that. Well, what's important? Is it important to feel safe? Is it important to be flexible? Is it important to feel stylish? You don't want to feel like you're encumbered by some monstrous machine. Is it important to be, you know, easy in, easy out, to sort of understand what else is going on. And again, save for your dissertation whether something is a goal or a value. It's like these things are all like what is going for and what needs to kind of inform your design. Then on the other side we have,
You know, what are the capabilities? What is somebody bringing to the problem? What kinds of things can they do? What kind of reach do they have? What kind of perception do they have? All the capabilities on the previous slides of perception, mobility, manipulation, imagination, expression. And then try to understand what are the constraints? You know, are there limitations on those capabilities? You know, with the person, what are the limitations in the situation that they want to be in, right? On being on a sailboat, you want to be on the water, well then, you can't have vehicles running in and out. And so, we put the Rubik's Cube here. The cube here is because these things are kind of like various facets of a problem. The yin yang gave us, they were just complementary things kind of going back and forth, but here we see they're really kind of, you look at one side, it's one way, but then you turn the other side and it gives you a different angle of the problem. Any quick question on that? Okay, I would like to turn over to John, who will proceed.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, Gail. So what I want to talk about are some more actual techniques for how do we go about doing the need finding that Gail said is important at the beginning of the process. How do we figure out the needs through some relatively straightforward techniques. I want to comment a little bit on that design process that Dave started off with. A lot of times need finding is presented as something you do up front. It's how you kind of identify what the main problem is. But I want to say that at the front is when you actually know the least about the problem. And I think it's important not to kind of make commitments and design decisions when you don't know as much about the problem. So one of the things that I'm going to recommend through these techniques is that you iterate the need finding throughout the design process. I mean, you begin with some ideas, but as you understand more, you'll be able to get a more precise or exact understanding of the need, which will help you in your design as well. So it's not just the prototype that you're iterating on, but also your understanding or your of the need. I hope we'll talk about three ways in which we can help identify needs through interviewing, through observing or ethnographic participation in people's activities, and through prototyping, trying things very quickly. Again, something that Dave mentioned in the beginning. So, we'll go through this very quickly, and the slides give you some more pointers to look for more information. You can read through them later. But interviewing, kind of pretty straightforward, as Gail mentioned, especially in working with people with disabilities, you need to understand from their point of view what are their goals, values, capabilities, constraints. And just on a practical level, interviewing, although we kind of do it on an everyday basis, in a more formalized way, you want to avoid asking leading questions. In general, you don't ask questions that begin with why, but you ask questions that begin with what or how. How does it make you feel? What are the reasons that you do things the way they do? And also, besides simply interviewing, asking them to show you how they do that. You know, if they have a task that they want to complete, you could ask them to show you how they currently complete it, and that will give you more insight into what the problems and opportunities are. So, for each method, we'll talk about some pluses and minuses. Interviewing allows you to engage directly with the user and collect information from them. And you get their perspective. How do they feel about it? How does it make them feel? A lot of those kind of goal questions you really can't get without trying to get inside of their head or asking them how they feel about things. On the con side, interviewing does take time. I mean, if you only have one user, you can focus on that user, but if you're looking for a more general solution, then you need to get some representation of different users. And that's, you have to be careful about how you generalize from those interviews, so either make sure you talk to enough different people with different capabilities that you can generalize, or just know the scope of what your observations or interviews are around is this smaller set of people. And then the last one, you know, what people say is often very different than what they do, and that actually leads into the next technique of observing. Sometimes it's called ethnographic observations or ethnographies, but that's really by very critically or carefully looking at what people are doing in the context of their activity. As much as possible, you want to approximate the design target for the situation. And what I think, in shifting from interviewing to observing, you're shifting to a focus on just the user to a focus on usage. How does the person, how does the user interact with their context, their environment? How do they accomplish things? And so you really want to pay attention to not only the person, but the context around them. Do this by shadowing them, following them along for a day, recording, using, you know, the video camera in your pocket or audio, or taking notes as you watch what they do. And the goal of observing, or the goal of an ethnography, is to get a rich, or sometimes it's called a thick description, or a very rich description of the activity. How are they accomplishing it? What resources are they using to accomplish their activity? And what hindrances get in the way? What challenges? Just to take an example of, you know, I think you might observe as a wheelchair user approaches a curb cut, what all do they do to navigate and get through that? Do they use other resources besides the wheelchair themselves? Do they kind of use the posts or some of the contextual environment to help them figure out exactly how to line up, or maybe even kind of grab onto a post to move things on? So it's a challenge to open your eyes to all the various resources, the things that the users are depending to accomplish their task, and what's the opportunity to make that easier, to make that a better situation. Okay, so again, pluses and minuses of observation. I think it really gives you a rich observation of the user's need. This is actually a technique that I use quite a bit. Working at Park, I work with some anthropologists that really have a systematic methodology for observing. And I should say, you know, in the course of your career, ethnographies are good to team up with social scientists that really have those skills, can figure out how to generalize. I mean, in the course of your class project, I don't know if you have that luxury, so you'll just have to be, if you pardon the phrase, armchair anthropologist, or kind of be as observant as you can with the resources that you have. This is one of the things I like about being in industry, is having kind of cross-functional teams where you have social scientists that can really help you with this kind of qualitative observation. I think observation helps you go beyond focusing on just the user, but on the entire use context. Again, this is something that takes time, skill, takes you, you know, a while to develop that kind of observational skill, and that's just a matter of practice. Again, you have to be careful about generalizing. And I think one thing that ethnography gets criticized is that it's hard sometimes to project into the future. I mean, it gives you a good understanding of how things are working now, but that's where all the designs training, which I'm assuming you're getting in this class and other classes, you know, the ability to intervene and change things, and again, build that prototype, observe how that prototype gets used, and iterate, so that you can kind of move out of the now and into, well, here are some possibilities of what we could do in this situation. Now, so a particular problem with observing talking about issues of accessibility is that maybe you have a limited access to a disabled population. I think it sometimes is hard to design also at scale. Like, it's very easy to focus on one person's needs, but how do you think about the much larger population? And maybe it's a little hard to get extended access to disability situations. But in that case, I'd like you to kind of think about, well, what are everyday situations where people experience a kind of a temporary or simulated disability. Anyone have any thoughts? And any situations that we actually encounter kind of on a daily or regular basis that are?
People with eyesight problems, before they've got glasses.
Great, great. Right, so before you put contacts on, that simulates low vision. Other examples? Talia? So, I'm not sure I heard, but it's sort of an attention management that you're focused on something? Oh, I see. So, you're right. A great example. That something, you're carrying something so you only have one hand available. Yeah. Sure. Right. So, injury or kind of temporarily kind of... again, losing the use of a limb or something like that? Yeah. Great. Or another example is, you know, being seatbelted in a car. We're basically in a limited mobility situation, and as a result, car cockpits are kind of designed to bring things into reach. So maybe if you're designing for limited mobility, you might actually be able to do some tests while people are strapped into their cars and kind of get some experience that way. Or I saw there was someone with a kind of a button device that if you have limited mobility, like with a glove, that could also give you that sense of disability. So, you know, there's a real opportunity to be creative about how you can create that context and then give people tasks to observe how they deal with that. And I think this will give you some of the experience of observation beyond looking at just one particular person with that specific disability. Okay, so the third type, and we're going to go through this very quickly, is prototyping. Again, this was in Dave's overall engineering process, but the notion of really quickly expressing your ideas at a conceptual level, again, before there's a lot of investment in the engineering or time, and getting it so that into people's hands so you can watch how they interact with it. You know, does this work? And I just want to go through a couple techniques that I hope you can very quickly do in your iterative design process. Hand-drawn sketches, small-scale models, or Wizard of Oz. So paper prototyping, very common in user interfaces like for a computer, maybe a little bit more of a challenge in disability situations, but the notion that you can very quickly with hand-drawn sketches, sketching out the various screens that a user would encounter and just sort of flipping it in front of them as they go through a task to get a sense of, is this going to work? Is this going to be a lot of complexity? Again, you can do this pretty quickly with a copier without investing engineering effort and get a sense at a high level of, you know, where are the points of complexity? Are you going to be able to fit this information in the screen size that you're looking at in a reasonable way? There's a nice example on the link that you can follow up later that shows a student project doing a paper prototype of a digital menu. And actually, now that more and more of this is happening digitally, you can go beyond just hand-drawn sketches to very quickly render PowerPoint or doing things on the web. And I saw this on the web, an example of kind of modeling context where you can insert disability in something, a virtual world like Second Life. Now, that takes its own kind of prototyping skill, but there is this opportunity where you can kind of model a world and impose some restrictions and be able to get a sense of how users would interact with that. So again, without having to build up the entire thing engineering-wise, being able to try or prototype or simulate. And the third method, which we call Wizard of Oz, which is really having a user simulate what the computer does in the situation. So having a user interact with the computer interface, but that interface is really being driven by someone behind the curtain doing what the computer should be doing if you had programmed it to do that. Actually, another way of doing this is to go through acting out skits. Again, using various props that you can find, but really act through the task as users interacting with the context. And just some pictures of this. In this case, it's a whiteboard kind of display, which is really being driven by kind of rear projection and someone else that's watching what the user's doing and causing things to happen that they should be, or in that case, I don't know if you can see clearly, but there's someone's crouched underneath the table, I think moving things underneath so that they can do that. Reminded me, Dave, a long time ago, did a project of an ultrasonic head cursor where, you know, the user had limited motion, but by moving their head, they would drive a cursor on the screen. That's a great Wizard of Oz thing that you could have done, I don't know if you did, where, you know, you could have the user move around the joystick and someone else could actually be driving the cursor, and you could get a sense very quickly, you know, how responsive the computer would have to be in order for, how accurate it would need to be in order for this idea to work. Okay, so prototyping, the goal here, very quick, cheap iterations, and really trying to get into actual usage as much as possible, and that you would learn from the usage experience, again, not only about your design, not only about the prototype, but about the core need itself, because sometimes that need finding up front is not exactly accurate, and by trying different things, you'll have a better, a more precise understanding of what the actual need is. On the other hand, prototyping can be relatively low fidelity, which means that you may not, it's not quite how much of a realistic reaction you're getting because of the low fidelity. And in prototyping, you often sort of have sort of scripted or garden path interactions that the user has to go through. You're not going to get the breadth and scope of interacting with a completely functional system, but hopefully you can structure it so that you can verify the core ideas behind that. I think those are rather quickly, but more or less on time, what we wanted to cover. Any questions before we move on to the next part about that?
It's not a question, but at MIT they have an H-Lab, and they actually have a sim called Magnus.
Now this is the hard part of the class, which is...
It's the fun part, too.
Well, it's a creative challenge, right? Because what we would like to do is to sort of get it, you know, get this whole group of about 35 people into groups of 4 to 6 people so you can kind of talk together and work on exercise. And the challenge is, right, our physical constraint, we have these funky immobile chairs and immobile tables. So I would like to suggest that to the extent that we can get a situation where, like, people in a row can kind of turn around and talk to the people behind them and it can kind of work there. So maybe even if you guys are going to do it, Ken, are you going to do the exercise? You're just... Okay. So, move in. Maybe even somebody, you know, you could just sit on a table while you're doing this. This is only going to be 15 minutes, so, you know, if you're in kind of a marginal situation, it won't matter much. So anyway, if you guys could do one or two groups here, and you guys kind of form a group, and you guys can kind of form a group, at least you can just sort of talk to each other, and then we're only going to do this for about 15 minutes, so it's, so, and this is, everybody can do it, you know, so community people, I mean, actually, it's more useful to even have somebody in the group that's not actually doing a project because they may have interesting ideas, right? So, are you guys, if it's only the three of you, that's okay. Yeah, great. And, all right, if you want to talk to these guys, go for it. Okay. You guys are okay? You guys, I will call you guys a group, so you guys talk to each other. Okay, now, let me give you the task, okay? So we want you to brainstorm, you know, for 10-15 minutes here on one of the projects that people, that you know, have been presented in the, you know, in last week's class, or last, the previous class. So like the, you know, sailboat chair or something like that. So between you, you know, think of one of the ones that you might want to talk about just for today. The scope of this is just for today. We want to, let's brainstorm on that. And then, the three areas that we talked about, you know, who would you go talk to learn more about the sailboat chair? What kinds of observations would you be, want to take? And what kinds of things would you make or build that could help you learn more? And with the idea of a prototype, is really not that that, okay, this is this a solution to the problem, but is this something that actually could help me understand what the person's capability is or the needs of the situation? So I'm going to leave that slide up there for now just as kind of a reminder. But just this is kind of just to kind of dive in and see what ideas you might have about how you could talk to people, what kinds of things you would look at, where you would go. Okay? Reasonably clear? Okay, go for it. All right. And I think if we... I am today, too. I'm surprised that we're this far at this point in time. Yes. Okay, that's it. It reaches out to you.